life's bad. They won't give peace a chance. It was just a dream some of us had. Still a lot of lands to see, but I wouldn't want to stay here. It's too old and cold and settled in its ways here. Ah, the California, California, I'm coming home. I'm gonna see the folks I dig.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not reflect those of KUCI, the KUCI management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI talk shows, log on to our website at kuci.org. Good morning and welcome to this November 13th, 2014 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'll give you more information on that later in the hour. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. It's my pleasure to welcome back Pulitzer Prize winning author Robert Olin Butler to the show this morning. Coming up in the second half hour, Caitlin Doty will be here to discuss her latest memoir, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, and other lessons from the crematory. If you have any sort of death fascinations as I do, you won't want to miss that. Robert Olin Butler is the Pulitzer Prize winning author of 15 novels, including The Hot Country, Hell, and A Small Hotel, including two previous Christopher Marlowe Cobb titles. He is the author of six short story collections, including A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain, which won the 93 Pulitzer Prize for fiction, and a book on the creative process, From Where You Dream. He has twice won a National Magazine Award in fiction and received the 2013 F. Scott Fitzgerald Award for Outstanding Achievement in American Literature. He teaches creative writing at Florida State University. He was on with me nearly exactly a year ago, November 6th of last year, with The Star of Istanbul, but it is his third Christopher Marlowe Cobb book is out now. The Empire of Night is published by The Mysterious Press. It's my pleasure to welcome Bob back on the show. Hi.
Hey, Marie. How are you? It's good to be back.
Thanks for coming back on. Some people are scared to come back on the second time, so it's always nice when
Oh, not me.
Back.
No. No, it's so much fun.
Good.
Sorry you don't have your campaign going again. I'd be happy to.
Well, you know, if anybody
sign some more books.
Yeah. Well, if anybody wants to call in and donate, we never stop that. You know, you can call.
Oh,
in
you never stop. Okay. Well, I got book plates at the ready here.
Perfect. So. Perfect. All right. People can let us know on our website, and yeah, that's a generous offer. We can get signed copies of Robert's book off to you. So tell us what Christopher's been up to in the past year since we talked last time. Fill us in on what he's doing.
Christopher, about 2 months later, after the end of The Star of Istanbul, is embarking on a cruise ship, or a passenger ship, actually, for Europe, heading there with the mandate to follow a suspicious character, a German professor and scientist who's on the ship. The ship happens to be the Lusitania, and it's May 5th, 1915. Indeed, the last fateful voyage of the Lusitania. There is someone else on the ship as well, a silent film star, a beautiful woman named Celine Bourgani, who becomes a very important character in this book. This is going to be Kit's Irene Adler, I think. You know, she may be back at some future point.
Nice. You'd always said that he reminds you, he's the fictional character who's kind of most close to your heart, either, you know, kind of biographically close to your heart. And I was wondering if he revealed something to you in this book that came as a surprise to you, or what he showed you this time.
You know what? Here's the thing. I think of the Cobb novels as a kind of ongoing single book. As a result, I have just described you, and your restraint was wonderful, Marie. Going, oh my God, poor Bob is out there. He's been working too hard. I just described you the second book, which we talked to about last year.
Yeah.
that the Lusitania does not involve, is not in the Empire of Night. I'm sorry. that was last time.
I was like, I've had a deja vu.
They really are all part of the same book, and I'm contracted for a fourth one, and I know where it's going from there. Celine, yes, that was in the Star of Istanbul. The Empire of Night. Let's back up. The Empire of Night. It involves Kit tasked with to checking out a possible mole in the British government. The war is underway for Britain in a big way, and the fact is that as far back 200 years prior, the first King George the First, became king. He was the only eligible heir of the dead Queen Anne, and he did not speak a word of English. He was German, and he was the father and grandfather and great grandfather and great great grandfather of a whole line of British royalty, including, for instance, Queen Victoria. And then Victoria up and married a German as well, Albert. And the Kaiser of Germany, who commenced World War I and who is the kind of the prime, you know, the uber enemy in the books and of England, was Queen Victoria's grandson. And so that kind of high-level interweaving of Germany and Britain at the in that country has produced a guy named Albert Stockman, mm-hmm. who Kit has to go check out at his under an assumed identity. And as a matter of fact, if you want to hear maybe 2-3 minutes of the opening of this book, there's another major character, which may be best introduced by just reading those few pages, if you'd like.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's do that.
Okay. And this is the very opening of The Empire of Night. I know a stage door Johnny when I see one, and I know a tough guy. This was no Johnny. I had my reasons not to look at the facade of the Duke of York's, and perhaps that's how I came to notice him down the alleyway on the south side of the theater. The midsummer's late sunlight was almost gone, and the play-going crowd was hubbubbing at the front doors, and here was this lurker in the shadows, around the corner, on the way to where only the company of actors was supposed to go. He'd crammed a bouncer's body into a 3-piece serge, and his trilby hat was pulled down and tipped forward. I gave off pretty much the same impression, I realized, but I wouldn't want to see somebody like me down this alley either. He was turned sideways and looking in my direction, probably thinking similar thoughts. There was nothing to do about it. Sniffing around on the sly for my government while still trying to more or less sniff the same way for my newspaper had made me excessively suspicious of my fellow man. I would have been a busy guy indeed if I'd tried to deal with every mug who put me on edge. The Trilby and I stared at each other for a long moment, and then he broke the gaze and slid away down the alley, fading into the shadows. I shrugged him off and figured it was time to go to my seat, which meant I had to face the wired sign thrusting out over the Duke of York's portico. In my coat pocket was a ticket for the front row of the stalls, so I had to deal with this. I turned. The theater event of the decade, for a limited run only, was ringed in electric lights. Isabel Cobb is Hamlet, my 56-year-old mother. When this ticket showed up on a bellhop tray at my hotel without a note, it took me by surprise. As close as I'd been to the theater all my life, I'd been unaware that the theatrical event of the decade was about to happen in London, much less that it involved my mother. I hadn't heard from or about her for 15 months. A couple of years ago, she retired from the legitimate theater, refusing to carry on in a profession that no longer let her pretend she was a 20-year-old beauty. She was still pretty much a beauty. but she wasn't Juliet anymore, or even Kate in Shrew, which an audience in Memphis finally, infamously, made clear enough to her summer before last. There would be no older woman roles for her, by God. She would rather leave it all behind. But here was a clever way around that problem. She was playing the most famous man in the history of the stage, a young man, even. Under the portico now, I found myself at the edge of a gaggle of shirt-waisted women, talking low among themselves, a few with a bit of purple, green, and white ribbon pinned near their hearts. Suffragettes, their focus shifted by the war. Instead of marching and chaining themselves to railings, they were starting to drive trams and buses and work in factories. Some of these women, near me, even gave off a whiff of sulfur from a munitions plant, their hands and faces beginning to turn faintly yellow from the chemicals. As we pressed together through the doors and into the foyer, my mother's name floated ardently out of these voices. Their new exemplar. She was to be a man. To be and not to be, of course. But tonight, a man. So that's the opening of the book, and his mother, who made an appearance back in the third book in a kind of subordinate way.
Yeah,
she's a very important character in this one. It turns out that she has also been enlisted to be of help, because this Sir Albert Stockman guy is a big fan of hers, a little bit in love with her, and so. She's also going to be part of this escapade. She's a major kind of co-character in this book, and the whole mother-son relationship, which is very complex, is an important feature here.
Did you have big plans for her all the way along? Did you know she was going to be a star in this book?
Yeah, I did. In the book that we talked about last year, and I started to talk about here this year too, and rightly so, they're all connected. She actually doesn't appear at all in that book, but I knew she was gonna come back eventually if the series went on, and if indeed this sort of monolithic larger book that's in my head got completed. And still not finished, but this is a major event. Yes, I knew she had to come back. She's too interesting, and she is too deeply embedded in Kit Cobb's psyche for her not to be back.
Right.
Then
right.
I'm as much interested, needless to say, given the kind of the way I write, I'm very much as much interested in the characters here as I am in their
plot.
External escapades.
Yeah, right. My guest this morning is Robert Olin Butler. The book, The Empire of Night, last year was the star of Istanbul, but they're all part of the Christopher Marlowe Cobb series. I promised our listeners, I put a copy of the postcard that prompted the short story that you wrote, and then these novels grew out of it. I put a copy of that up on Facebook for our fans to look at, and I can't stop looking at it. So I promised to them that you would talk a little bit about the postcard that inspired all of this, that gave rise to it, and, how that postcard, how all of this came out of that.
Yeah, for those of you who missed it last year or forgotten, and as I have, what I said, this card, so let's assume everybody has seen it. It is a card that is what they call a real photo postcard. I collected this card years ago at some postcard convention. It's a photograph someone took of a man walking on a city street, taken from behind, and he's in a white shirt and dark trousers, and he's walking along a street in clearly a Spanish-speaking country, and the storefronts are all in Spanish. Way up in the distance, in the middle distance, there's a gaggle of people. That's twice I've used gaggle on the show. I would have had edited that out. But some people up there, and he is drawn, because the man who's in the picture is the guy who wrote the postcard, and he's drawn an arrow pointing at one of a woman in white up there. And And on the back, he says, after the battle, notice the pretty senoritas in this photo. The one in white does my laundry. And what I haven't mentioned yet, and what he's not even looking at as he walks by, is that he's walking just at arm's length. He's just now passing on the sidewalk next to him two dead Mexican men in pools of blood. And indeed, the battle then I took to be, and I think I'm quite right about this, was a little, sort of a little-known invasion of Mexico that the United States undertook in April of 1914, when we went into Mexico because we didn't like the dictator there, and we wanted to protect American oil interests, and we assumed the Mexican people would welcome us with open arms as liberators from this awful president. And so, which turns out, I guess, to be an old American tradition. Seems a little familiar. Yeah. And that's it. That's what began this book. The British editions of these three books are going to be published over the next 6 months. And indeed, they've incorporated that picture into the back cover of the Hot Country, which is coming out.
That's great.
Next month.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Yeah, it's such a rich photograph, obviously. And I was wondering how much of that. So talk a little bit about the jump between that photo and this dreamscape that came out of that photo. What you started thinking about, and kind of how all of this spun out of that.
Yeah, I mean, this was more like George H.W.'s invasion of Iraq rather than George W.'s invasion, because Woodrow Wilson went into Veracruz, Mexico, but then didn't go very much farther, and the American press went down there to cover the event, and everybody then sat around in Veracruz while the American Army cleaned up the garbage in the city and brought in new galvanized steel garbage cans and just tried to make things, you know, tidy things up in our kind of oddly mixed way. You know, we'll go in and invade a country and then try to make them, you know, help them out in this kind of quotidian way. And the main character who interested me was an American journalist and war correspondents. At the beginning of the 20th century, were rock stars. Yeah, there were 2,600 newspapers in the United States. New York City alone, the four boroughs of New York, had 61 daily newspapers.
Wow.
In 1914.
Wow.
Over 80% of all reading in the United States was the reading of newspapers.
Wow.
And, of course, this was before radio, before movies. There were very few photos, especially from abroad. They couldn't wire photos yet. And so the newspapers were everybody's TV series and reality TV, and they loved crime and they loved war stories, and the guys who went abroad, they were all men, were to cover war. As I said, they were like rock stars because they were writing these intense purple prosed, often accounts of battle, which people just ate up in the newspapers, and my background was in journalism for a long while, and I just thought he was an interesting guy, and he was sitting there cooling his heels because the war wasn't going anywhere, and then falls in the first book in the series into a German plot. And the thing that drives all stories of all kinds are the goals, the objectives that the central character in the narrative has. And when I teach the literary genre, which is what I teach here at Florida State University, you know, I use another word for those goals and objectives, yearning, because it, it, it suggests the deepest level of goal, objective, desire. You know, fiction is the art. Fiction is an art form of, that moves forward in time. It's a temporal art form. And it's about human beings, and it's about human feelings. And you can ask any Buddhist, and this is one of the great truths of the religion, that as a human being with feelings on this planet, you cannot exist for even 30 seconds of time on planet Earth without desiring something. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, desire, goal, objective, yearning. That's what's at the heart of narrative. Fiction, inevitably, is the art form of human yearning. And so what I was looking for in that guy in the picture was what is his goals and objectives as far as the surface genre, the espionage aspect of it. And I gave him that in his having a what they called a king beat, you know, an exclusive story, and he ends up following a German agent who's been smuggled on into Mexico, and follows him up to, because he has a kind of unholy alliance he has that Germany wants to form with Pancho Villa, and so on the one level that's what Christopher Marlowe Cobb is after. However, if there is a unified field theory of yearning, that is the literary yearning, that if you go down to the next levels of what the goals are, and you know the pure entertainment genres, the character pretty much stays at that level. He is a detective. That's who he is. That's set. And then as a detective, or as a spy, that's who he is. And he's got this objective in the external world to, you know, the crime to solve or the secret to suss out. The literary work, and if there's if there's one thing that is most literary works, narrative works, where that the central character yearns for, it is, I yearn for a self. Mm. I yearn for an identity. Mm. I yearn for a place in the universe. And Kit is in restless search for that. Who he is in terms of a man, in terms of the ethical challenges that confront him with the work he does because he becomes an agent of the U.S., who he is as an American, and even more, who he is because of being the son of this famous mother, and not knowing even who his father was. I mean, and that's why looking at this series as a kind of single monolithic uber novel, it is getting more and more complex in that challenge to Kit Cobb, the great who the hell am I, which is the thing that every human being on this planet wakes up every morning and asks themselves on one level or another.
Right, right. You always talk about writing from a, not writing with the conscious mind at the forefront, but kind of accessing this, you know, murky, you call it the compost of imagination, or I guess Graham Greene called it the compost of imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And that strikes me as easier to do in short work and harder to do over the course of the spans of these three novels. Is that true? You know, is it difficult to maintain that subconscious brain? Or, you know, it strikes me that a thriller is very structured and that certain things have to happen and the plot is more important than the character. But you don't, mm-hmm. But this doesn't feel like that. This feels, you know, very character-driven.
Right. Thank you. I'm glad it doesn't. And it doesn't, but it's true. All narrative objects have plots, and that's why the yearning thing is so important. If you have a serious fix on what the yearning of your central character is, that's what makes this all work. Because plot is simply yearning challenged and thwarted.
Mm-hmm.
And the book works on more than one level. And yes, there is an external, when one takes on some of the major elements of more entertainment focused, more external plot driven types of books. You do have to make that the book fit together on that level effectively, but the decisions you make on that level are always also driven by that deeper level. The people are always not turning out to be who one thinks they might be. That the issue of identity, of who am I, is at the heart of most of the twisting and turning in the espionage thriller plot of these books.
Right.
And so those issues never divorce themselves from each other. They are a kind of organic whole. And so once that's clear, then staying in the unconscious, and the way I've always said it to my students, because the problem I have with every creative writing student I've ever had in my 30 years of teaching is that virtually all of them are writing from their heads. They're writing from their willed analytical minds. And art does not come from the mind. It does not come from ideas. It does not come from analytical thought. It comes from the unconscious, the white hot center, the compost heap, as Green called it. But that place is such a roiling mess that there has to be a governing principle, and that's why this thing of yearning is so crucial, and it's so sadly missing in almost all the work of aspiring writers that come to that I get my hands on until I get my hands on them at least. Because those who have aspire to the literary genre. The entertainment genres, that the goal, the objective, which is just a shallower, closer to the surface. I don't mean a shallow in a pejorative way, but just a closer to the surface version of yearning. Those entertainment genres, they are not only do they have those goals built in. That's often what identifies them as the genre, the mystery novel, the goal is to solve the mystery, the legal thrillers, the goal is to, a legal matter, to prove the innocent man innocent, or in the horror novels, the goal is to escape the monsters, and so forth. The literary genre, it is not so clear.
Right.
That's why I think I've come to that conclusion that it's really about identity mostly. But the problem then is that young writers end up not having that unifying principle embedded in them, and so they can't approach their unconscious. They end up trying to think their way into the issues of the book. And what that usually, the most deceptive and common alternative for yearning in the aspiring literary work is problem, that they are writing about characters who have problems. Now, if you have a problem, there's a kind of faint, goal of somehow not having the problem, getting out of the problem, but that's not strong enough to drive vigorous literary narratives forward. And so this yearning thing, the problem has to turn into the dynamic of desire to make narratives go. But once you've got that, then you can go into that place. And on a line-to-line basis, every scene you write, every breath you take, that the yearning is there for you in the character, and it allows you to make all these other decisions.
I love the dynamics of desire, and I always feel like literary fiction, the beautiful literary fiction to me always makes me feel less alone in the world. It makes me feel like, wow, they had that really weird idea too, and suddenly I don't feel so isolated in my skin.
Yeah, Absolutely, absolutely. And that's why I think there's this yearning thing is the key. Because closer to the surface objectives or ways in which we that seem to be what, you know, the matters of race and gender and culture and ethnicity and religion and politics, all these things that provide people and characters with goals and objectives or a matrix of those things. Those things, if you look deeply enough, every one of those things is an attempt to define the self.
Right.
And why you feel like you're not alone in your skin is that what the things that your skin seem to imply about who you are, in our deepest existential level, it's not. Even those of us who cling most tightly to those demographic things about ourselves to define ourselves, we do it because it doesn't quite get the job done. And a lot of bad things happen in the world because we draw that circle around us and try to convince ourselves that we are these things, and everyone on the outside of this is not only not us, but a kind of implicit challenge to us.
Right.
It's because if they are right about who they are, or if they are virtuous because of who they are, then I am not. I don't know who I am anymore.
Right.
And so it's that deepest ontological thing at your very being, who am I, what am I doing here, where do I belong, and that's what I think real literature gets at. It gets down there, and when you get down there, then man, you could talk to anybody, and that you can, that you feel not alone by entering into characters who are quite different from you in the ways that the world normally says are crucial differences. That's an even more profound experience.
Right. Bob Butler, I could talk to you for 1,000 years. I wish I could.
Well, how about next November?
Next November.
We'll try this again.
Next November, we'll do it again. We'll do it again. Robert Olin Butler, the book Empire of Night. I will look forward to having you back on next year. There's so much more to talk about.
Always great talking to you, Marie. Thank you.
Thanks so much. That was Robert Olin Butler, the book Empire of Night. I really recommend his book, From Where You Dream. It is full of really insightful writerly advice, comments, insights. He is a wellspring of that. I just read a piece of advice he gave recently I'm sure he gave it years ago, about not flattening out one character to boost up another one. And I've been sort of meditating on that a little bit. That's really insightful advice and a trap that I often fall into. So if that helps you out, I hope it does. Stay tuned. Caitlin Doty is going to be on in just a few moments. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back.
It was a rainy night. We took a taxi to your mother's home. She went to Florida and left you with your father's gun alone. Upon her small white bed, I fell into a dream. You sat up all the night and watched me, just to see who in the world I might be. Oh, I am from the Sunday school. I sing soprano in the upstairs choir. On the FM radio.
sat up all the night and listened to thee.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We are streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are a podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under College Radio, or you can always visit Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. There are direct downloads up there, information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events. We are also on Stitcher, as well as you can find us on Facebook under Writers on Writing. If you like our page, there are podcasts galore up there as well. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. I'm joined now by Caitlin Doty. Caitlin is a licensed mortician and the host and creator of the Ask a Mortician web series. She founded the Death Acceptance Collective, the Order of the Good Death, and co-founded Death Salon. Her book is Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory. It's published by Norton, and it's my pleasure to welcome her on this morning. Caitlin, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So I'm going to, you know, nobody introduces a book better than the writer, so I am going to let you talk about the memoir, your decision to write it, and kind of take us into a little of the scope so we can jump off from there and talk about it a little. Can you talk about Smoke Gets in Your Eyes?
Yes, absolutely. It is memoir, but it's part memoir and part, I guess, historical exploration. So what I'm trying to get at is why we have this negative relationship with death in Western culture. And part of the exploration of that is through my own experiences working in a crematory as a 23-year-old. And then part of that is looking at the history, looking at our relationship with death culturally and in other cultures to try and see where we went wrong in our own culture, and then hoping to combine those two into something that is a good reader experience.
Did you know when you were working at the crematory that a book would come out of it? Did you have that in the background of your head?
I did. And what's interesting about that is that I never had a book in my head before that in my life at all. It's not like I was a writer looking for an angle of some sort.
Yeah.
I had always loved reading, but I had never considered myself somebody who wanted to write more or be the production end of literature. But for some reason, when I got in there, it was just so inspiring. The characters were so interesting, so strange, and I just felt like people needed to know what was happening behind the scenes, and all of a sudden, I felt like I was a writer.
Yeah. This is one of those careers that you often hear, you know, well, it takes a certain sort of person to do that, and I'm wondering what kind of, if you feel that's true, and if you feel like, is there a kind of person that it takes, and if you're sort of born a mortician or made a mortician,
I do think people think that. I think I do hear that a lot. Like, well, somebody has got to do it. And what I have come to believe through doing the work is that somebody should be everybody. Right. That somebody should be all of us. Nobody should be the type of person who just hands off their death to somebody else, to a professional.
Right.
We should all be involved in the death care process. And that, for people in the 21st century, that thought can be really uncomfortable because we're not used to interacting with dead bodies anymore. We're not used to interacting much with ritual around death anymore. Even among religious groups, there's not much ritual anymore, or at least not as much as there used to be. So there's a real fear of taking on that responsibility, but I think that we would be a better culture if we did.
Yeah. Yeah, the book is really, I couldn't tell if you wrote it as separate, I mean, they feel like they could be standalone essays, and you know, trying to figure out how to parse out the book, but a lot of your early experiences I thought were wonderful. Your own early experiences with, well, some of them weren't wonderful, but you had a chapter on a fish, that you had a fish as a little girl, and this notion, and your dad kind of played a trick on your mom, I'll let you tell the story, but this notion of cheating death and how we talk to children about death, and you know, how our very earliest conceptions are about death, and whether it's scary, whether it's natural, whether it's, you know, how we form these in children. And I was wondering if some of those formative experiences you felt set you up for the career you went into.
I do think so, and I'm really passionate about how we talk to children about death because I don't think that we do it very well, honestly.
Right.
So I would say that there's something that we could do is just be a lot more honest with children about what death is and why it happens and how it happens. And the story that you're referring to is when I was about, probably about 5 or 6, I got a little goldfish that came and lived in our house, and it got the disease where it turns white and floats there and dies. And my mother discovered it, and she woke up in the morning, and the fish was lying there dead, and it was floating around. And so my dad went to the...
Please enter the number you wish to dial.
Whoops, we lost Caitlin. I'm going to put on a little music, get her back, and we'll keep up with this discussion. Hold on.
Three waitresses all wearing black diamond earrings, talking about zombies and Singapore slings. No trouble in their faces, not one anxious voice, none of the craze you get from too much choice. The thumb and the satchel or the rented Rolls Royce. You think she knows something, a second refill. You think she's enlightened as she totals your bill. You say, show me the way to Bar and Grill.
All right, we're back on with Caitlin. I will. I'm so sorry you got rudely cut off there. I'm sorry about that. Why don't you?
I'm right in L.A. too.
I know. You could drive here.
Really?
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, so I was talking about my dead fish, wasn't I?
You were.
Isn't that where we were?
That's where we were.
And it died. My little fish died, and my dad took it out, flushed it down the toilet, and went and bought another fish that matched the dead fish. So when my mother came home, she thought it was dead, and she thought she was going to have this first conversation with her 5-year-old about death, and the fish was alive, so it didn't matter. And she was terrified, and I got the sense that you could cheat death, and that death wasn't really a thing that you couldn't conquer by just buying a new one. Hmm. And there's a lot of things in children's media, especially like cartoons, that tell us, oh, there's always another one. You know, if the Roadrunner or whatever it is jumps off the cliff, and Wile E. Coyote gets the anvil on his head, he pops back up and he's fine. Mm-hmm. And so when somebody actually dies in a child's life, it can be a really traumatic experience because they don't really get a sense of that until that time.
Right. And do you? I assume that those experiences set kids up for their later encounters with death. And I'm wondering in societies, because the book also has some really wonderful... as you mentioned, historical looks at how other cultures deal with death and rituals surrounding death, not just but historically and across culture. And I assume other places, obviously, they do this better. And what do you, I don't know. I'd love to hear your advice on how you would treat your own kids, what you would tell them now, and what rituals you see as being positive, good rituals to set up, you know, so that the surviving are healed in the process.
Sure. I don't have any children. But what I would say is that, again, being completely honest, letting the children take part in whatever ritual around death you have. So if it's just going to the funeral or going to see grandpa's body or going to touch grandpa's body or be there with him, that's something that they should be able to do. So often you hear, oh, no, don't take the kids to the funeral. That's going to scar them. That's going to make it weird. It's actually much more weird to keep the kids at home when they know things are going on. And, right. And trying to shroud them like that is a much, much more damaging decision, I think.
Right.
And then making sure that you set up an environment that any questions they have are completely acceptable around death. So if they want to, anything that they ask, and so often we paste our own fears as adults onto children. And so we let them know very clearly with our actions that their questions are not acceptable because they're a threat to us in some way and our own fears about death. So I guess the advice would be don't do that. Let your children ask whatever questions they want and don't make things off limits because you're afraid of them.
Right, right. Yeah, and the book has a wonderful balance of detail, humor, information. It does all of those things. And I wanted to talk a little bit about voice, finding voice for the memoir, so that it's accessible. It's not excessively off-putting in the details, which I thought were just spot on. You know, there was just enough to give you the sense of it, but it didn't go over the top. So talk a little bit about finding voice, if that varied from chapter to chapter, and you know, kind of if it was a problem for you to find that balancing act of how much detail to put in.
It is a balancing act, but that's pretty much what I do in my day-to-day life, is because I do this public advocacy. I do a web series called Ask a Mortician, and I have a website, and all of what I do is finding that exact balance in how to present things. Because on one hand, if you become too saccharine and too sweet, then people don't want to read it or don't want to engage with it. But if you go too far and you're too explicit or you're too gruesome, then people don't want to read it either. So it really has to walk a very fine line between those two extremes. And I really do try to do that, and that's very much a part of what I think about every day as I do the work that I do. And for this book, I didn't want to pull any punches at all. I wanted to make sure that I was describing things as they were, but never in a salacious way.
Right.
So if I'm talking about how you grind the bones after a cremation, that's because people should know that this is how a cremation works, not because I want you to be so shocked and titillated by bone grinding. It has I guess making sure that everything always has a purpose and that the information always has a purpose.
Yeah, that's a good observation. That's a good description, is that it never felt salacious or it never felt, you know, voyeuristic or something seedy, but it was very matter of fact. And I think that's the voice that that's the voice you have to achieve in order to be honest about what's going on. And some of the things that I found fascinating. I mean, I don't know how I felt about embalming before reading the book. I'm certainly against it now. So, you know, you're right. There's a lot of things here people either don't let themselves think about, or they think about and pretty quickly dismiss. And they're important topics. But let's talk a little bit about the options that people have that they don't realize they have when their loved ones die. I didn't realize that you could be there for your loved one's cremation, that you could actually participate in that.
Yeah, there's really two big things that I think people aren't aware of that are options. One is the witness cremation, which means that you can come and be there when the body is. You can sit with the body for, you know, an hour or two or however long you'd like before the cremation, and then go with the body into the crematory and watch it be loaded into the machine and even push the button to start the process, which can feel very ritual and very healing, even if you're not a particularly religious or ritualistic person. And then the other one is that it's perfectly legal to keep the body at home for one day, 2 days, 3 days, however long you need to feel more comfortable with the death. The body's not going to start decomposing immediately. It's not going to start, you know, it's not going to go weird immediately. You have that time to sit with the body and say goodbye and not just immediately send it off with a funeral director.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it must be the case that because everything is done so much behind closed doors, that we either mystify it or we, like you say, we put our fears onto children. We probably put many more fears onto the process because it's so unknown to us and so mysterious. And, you know, the body just kind of disappears. And all of the funerals I've been to, you can't even watch it be buried. You know, that happens after you leave the cemetery. It's, you know, you're just left with a casket kind of sitting in the grass.
Right. That's the worst. I think when they do that, they put the basically astroturf over the pile of dirt.
Right.
And then the casket is sitting on the straps above the grave, and you come and you say goodbye, and then they just make you walk away while the casket is still floating there above the grave. And you don't get the experience at all of the transition of the person being above the ground and then going below the ground and below the earth, and that's them, they're gone, and now you put the dirt on top, and it's different now. And that's part of the process. And if you're making somebody walk away before that happens, especially the really close family members, you're not getting that transition.
Right, right. My guest this morning is Caitlin Doty. The book is Smoke Gets in Your Eyes. It's published by Norton, and it's a collection of, I almost read them as a collection of essays, but it's part memoir, it's part sort of informational, historical, cultural ways that we deal with death, and it's fascinating. I've long had a fascination with this subject matter, and this is a really great way to get access to the behind the scenes of what you don't know about. I also didn't know that a new technique is, I guess you don't call it cremation. What do you call it? Cremation by water is a new
right.
Green way to deal with your loved ones after they die. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. It's called reclamation, and it uses really high heat water and lye, the chemical lye, in a combination of almost flash decomposition. Hmm. So what you end up with is powder similar to cremated remains. And there's a funeral director in Minnesota who's offering it, and he gave a talk that was really fascinating because he told us that about 80% of his clients now are choosing this water cremation, this alkaline hydrolysis, over traditional cremation. One, because they like the green aspect of it. It's better for the environment. Cremation uses a lot of natural gas. And two, it's the idea of water is somehow more comforting than the idea of flame, which we're still a little icky about, even though close to 50% of us will choose cremation.
Right. Yeah, I think, I don't know, everybody must have this ingrained fear in them that, okay, I really know they're dead. I know it, but mm-hmm. This is really final, you know, whereas, isn't that everybody's greatest fear is being burned alive or being buried alive? And you're right. We project all of these fears onto onto the process.
Right.
And yeah, it's
mystifying. And what you do learn with working with dead bodies, though, is that they're so dead. They're so very dead. And you can really see that. You can tell that they've left the building. They're gone. But again, in a society where we don't really see it, and all of that is hidden and done by professionals, it's absolutely, especially for children or young adults, it absolutely makes sense that the mind would run wild and that we would think, you know, is grandpa sleeping under there and he's going to wake up in his casket? Or right. If mom's cremated, does that mean she's being burned alive? And you can see why the imagination would go there.
Well, especially with the embalming and display process in the casket, you know, my experience with death in when there are viewings is that they look more alive than they looked, you know, 3 days ago when they were in the hospital. They look like they could wake up, you know, and my grandmother was holding a deck of cards and, she looked like she could sit up and play a hand. And that made it even more disturbing because, you know, it was hard to accept that she was dead because she looked so alive.
Well, and it has a kind of uncanny valley aspect to it. Like now, live in Technicolor, a little strange, a little off.
Right.
And that's what I find with embalmed bodies. And what's nice, I believe, about sitting with an unembalmed body or having the unembalmed body in your home is that you can see the little changes. And when you say the little changes that death brings, you get the reaction of, oh, why would I want to see that? Why would I want to see the little changes of death? Because it helps you transition. It helps make the whole thing easier.
Yeah.
You can tell this person is not here anymore. And you get used to the idea that they are if you believe they're in a different place, then you can see that. If you believe that the body is just dead and that's it, you can come to terms with that. But it's just the process of noticing that this person is no longer present in the community.
Right, right. Here's something I've long wondered. Why are mortuaries always family-owned? It feels like every mortuary underneath it says family owned since blah, blah, blah. And why why is that?
Well, what's, what's funny about that is that a lot of them aren't now. So what's happened is that corporations will come in and they'll buy, you know, O'Malley and Sons or whatever it is, but they'll keep the name. So when, you know, there'll be a little trademark of Dignity Memorial or whatever it is underneath it, but the family won't actually own it anymore, but all of the signage and everything will still be the same because you can say, well, my family's been going to O'Malley and Sons since the First World War. That must be, you know, this must be the right place, but it's now corporately owned.
Gotcha. My husband hypothesized that it's because laws are grandfathered in, and so if a new law comes down about how to cremate a body, it wouldn't apply if the business has been in operation.
That's not true. Laws are universally applied.
Okay.
Well, they're universally applied in the state. Each state has different rules about death care, which makes it confusing, too, because if you can say someone in California, oh, you can absolutely do this, you can't necessarily say the same thing to someone in New York.
Gotcha. Right. That makes sense. Yeah, well, that's good to know, because I thought maybe if you're going to these family-owned mortuaries, they're using very archaic old methods or something. You know.
No. That's something, though. I mean, that, you know, you don't want to give the funeral industry something else to,
to be
sketchy about.
Good point. Caitlin Doty, we've run out of time, and I really could talk to you forever. This is fascinating. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you. That was Caitlin Doty. The book is Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory. Again, she has a web series, Ask a Mortician, and you can find her, The Order of the Good Death, and the co-founder of Death Salon. She has a lot of information on options that you might not know are available in afterlife care, and she's a fascinating resource. She's got a website. You can check her out there. That's all the time we have for. Barbara also wanted me to mention that not only can you find us on Facebook under Writers on Writing, but we are also on Twitter, Writers on Writing. It's at WOWKUCIFM. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, podcasting on iTunes, as well as Barbara's website, penonfire.com. I will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock, and Teddy is coming up next with some reggae. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.
Rain comes from the east one night, we watch it come to hang like beaded curtains to the morning sun. Water dripping from our clothes, you with raindrops on your nose, ask me sadly, please don't go away now. Till the rain is done, I'll say I'll stay. Rain outside, but inside, we don't mind at all. Shadows by the fire, slowly climb and fall. Kisses fade and leave no trace.